Accession number 9434, reel 15.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 15. I believe before the action at La Hamel, there was an incident on the Somme where you were very late crossing the bridge. Do you think you could take us through that incident?
Yes. Well, after we left Piron, we went almost due south through Brie to St. Christ, and crossed the river again. After having crossed the river at Piron, we went back over the Somme again, and were there for a few hours, and nothing seemed to happen. And suddenly it went quiet, and all the troops in the neighbourhood were streaming over a small bridge, about 14 feet wide, I suppose, over the Somme. And we've got about 50 yards or so on the right side, when my CO came to me and said, get a wheel stretcher, take three men, and go back across the river and search the area thoroughly for stragglers, especially wounded stragglers who may not be in very good shape, and get them back across. So, of course, I had to go back. But when I got to the bridge, and there was the sapper of the Royal Engineers sitting with his hand on a high explosive switch, and he said to me, where are you going? So I said, well, I've orders to go back across the river and search the area thoroughly for stragglers, especially wounded stragglers. And he said, well, he says, I'm blowing this bridge in 5 minutes. So I said, look, have a heart. I've got to get over there and search the area. Give me a quarter of an hour. He said, I'll give you 10 minutes. Anyway, we crossed the bridge, and I spread my men out, searched the area thoroughly, but after about a quarter of an hour, when I was absolutely sure there wasn't a living soul that side of the bank, we came back, and he said to me, look, he says, you've overstretched your time. He says, I'm blowing this bridge right away. We hadn't got 50 yards up on the right side of the bridge when I heard the explosion, and the bridge went up. And so that was a very hair-raising moment, because we could have easily been left on the wrong side of the bridge, and there was no way we'd have got across the Somme.
So it's from here that you went down to La Hamel, the La Hamel position.
Yes, from here we went. From here we went. We turned again. By the way, this was Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday when we were at that bridge, and I thought that it was a lovely day, and the birds were singing, because there hadn't been any fighting there, and we turned north after leaving the bridge, went up to the Somme again in the direction of Bray, and we crossed the river at Bray and went almost north, and matter of fact, the 1st Cavalry Brigade actually went into Third Army territory and came under their orders. But we didn't go any farther north than Bray, and we were only there 24 hours and turned again. But while we were at Bray, it was very interesting. We got there very late at night, almost probably 1 o'clock in the morning, and we had a Canadian medical officer attached to us, who had been given the job of getting our billet settled with the staff officer, the staff captain. And he walked around with him and walked around, and in the end, the staff captain turned to him and said, well, he said, do you want anything? He said, do you think I'm stopping around after you for fun? The Canadians had no respect for red tabs. Anyway, we got billet. He said, all right, take anywhere you like here, staff captain said. And that was in Bray. Well, the next day, at the end of the next day, after that day there, we were turned east again, and we found ourselves very late at night at La Hamel, the western end of La Hamel. So quite a small village, the western end, and there we were until the battle opened on the following day, the 28th, on the Thursday.
And that's where you were wounded?
Yes, that's where I had a very bad time there. I was We were getting, it was casualties were streaming onto my post, and the Captain Swan, the medical officer there, he was as busy as he could be dressing casualties. But he said that there came a point in it when I had to stop because the shelling became rather intense, and I sat down on a bank, and my back against a bank, right next to a Lewis gunner of the 16th Irish Division who had got in there, and he was firing, and I was sitting on my bank. All of a sudden, I went out. I heard, my hat was forced down on my head, and I went unconscious. I'd been blown unconscious by a shell burst.
Now, you said last time you said you suffered from many of the symptoms of shell shock when you came round. You're very nervous and didn't like loud noises. Could you talk a little bit more about those symptoms?
Yes, well, when I came round, I was wandering about, and I looked down at a section of the bank a little farther on, and I saw that the infantry had dug themselves into slit trenches. That was the first time I'd seen a slit trench similar to the ones which were used in the last war. They dug themselves into narrow slit trenches in this bank, and an officer there looked up at me and says, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" See? And he said, "Get away farther up there." That's, he pointed up to the end of the road, towards a wood. And I was half woozy from the explosion, and just then a stream of machine gun bullets came over. I could have almost put my hand out and touched them. The sound was like a 100 gas taps turned on all at once. They were hissing past me, and I went down, instinct put me on the floor. I went down, face down, flat on the ground to get under the cover of the bank. Well, after they'd gone, I got up and I went back. Went to, up farther out of the way until it eased off a bit, but I was very shocked. There was no doubt about that.
And how did you feel? What symptoms did you
have?
Well,
heavy in the head, and not thinking clearly. You see, I can remember. I didn't think. I still couldn't tell you exactly what I did to this day, except that I wandered around and I found myself back with the post again.
Were you very jumpy, affected by noises or such like?
Oh, after that, I the following day, when I felt my back was all, the back of my neck was all itching and sore, and I took my coat off, and it was all ragged and torn, and I found that the Captain Swan examined me and found that I'd got pinhead shell wounds right across the back of my neck and across the back where they penetrated the cloth and sort of scarred right across the back of the shoulder and the neck. But they weren't deep, and they picked out all the pieces, gave me a double dose of anti-tetanic serum, and said, "Soldier on." But I was very shocked.
Right. Did you stay at your duties?
Yes, I stayed at duties, and the next job I had was with I went with Captain Fitzgerald to up to a post, one of the huts on the old Villers-Bretonneux airfield, and out in front of Villers-Bretonneux, and between Villers-Bretonneux and a place called Marcel Cave, which was up the main St. Quentin Road and was in German hands. And, of course, from the Steve Church steeple there, they could see everything we did.
Now, I believe that... was it before that or after that you saw the interrogation of a conscripted Pole? Because that was quite interesting.
Before I went up there, one day... By the way, the Australians came and took it over, but we had a man brought in to the post, a German... in German uniform, who'd got a bullet, a machine gun bullet through his knee, and it had swelled up like a football. And I bent over, I was dressing him, putting a dress dressing on him, and an intelligence officer came up and started to question him. I can remember that German, well, he wasn't a German, he was a Pole, I can remember his name to this day. It was Stanislas Korvonsky. And he was very, very shaky and fearful of what we were going to do to him. But the intelligence officer was questioning him as to whether there were any German Marines on the front facing us. And he shook his head and said no. And then the intelligence officer said, take his other boot off. I want to look at his feet. And we took him off, and he says, as I expected. The feet were in a shocking condition. They were all bandaged and raw from blisters. How he walked, God knows, but they were all raw from blisters. And that's when I learned how the intelligence people work. He said, this intelligence officer remarked, as I thought, he says, a long marching, hard marching, and a little care.
And what did he mention, what he deduced from that?
Well, he deduced from that the Germans were getting a bit thin on the ground there, because they weren't satiated with reinforcements as had happened through the earlier part of the attack, you see. They were getting short of men in that particular area.
Now, before you went up with Fitzgerald to the Villers-Bretonneux post, how were you treated while you were at the field ambulance, while you were recovering from your shell shock?
Normal. I carried on normally, tried to forget it, and I think that was probably the best thing. I sometimes think that the COs sent me up to Villers-Bretonneux with the idea of kill or cure, you know, to see if I couldn't stand it up there, then I should have to go back to rest at the base.
Were you still woozy and still nervous? Or
I was jumpy at every sound. Every sound, every explosion, I half jumped out of my skin.
Did you get sympathetic treatment from your fellow...
Oh, yes, they were sympathetic, yes.
So now, you went up to this first aid post at Villers-Bretonneux. Where exactly was it?
Well, it was in a hut on the airfield, and looking straight up the main road from Villers-Bretonneux to St. Quentin. As straight as an arrow the road ran, it was a main road, and there was this village at the other end, Marshall Cave, which was in German hands, and they could see everything we did. They used to send over... The shells came over intermittently. None had hit us, but they were hitting the middle of the road accurately every time. I think they were ranging on that road for the attack on Villers-Bretonneux, which came about 10 days after we'd left.
Now, what was your role? What was your job meant to be? Were you running the forward...
I was running the aid post there, yes.
Your usual job at the advance post?
Usual job, yes, addressing anything that came along.
Now, when you came under shell fire, how did it affect you?
Pardon?
When you came under shell fire with your shell shock...
Well, I used to have to take a firm grip of myself. And to stand it, you see. I had to, I used to jump a bit at every sound, but I used to say, well, I've got to stand it. And gradually, it diminished until I could stand it. But in those days, shell shock had hardly, had only become... to be recognized. Before that, everyone said it was funk, you see. But before that they received, the medical authorities were recognizing that there was such a thing as shell shock.
Did you feel embarrassed by your condition, or did you...
No, I didn't feel embarrassed. I just felt struggling to carry on, you know, as normal.
What was happening while you were at this aid post? Are there any incidents or...
While I was there, yes, I had an eyewitness view of the crucial battle for Amiens, about 3 miles, 2 to 3 miles on due south from us, was the Hangard, and that is where the 2nd Cavalry Division, who was commanded by a Major General T.T. Pittman, the colonel I'd taken the message of relief to earlier in the war, he was there with, and it contained the Canadian Cavalry Brigade, and there isn't much doubt that the shelling that of the Hangard was the heaviest I'd heard since the 21st morning of the 21st of March, and one of the heaviest that year. But the Germans tried very hard to break through there, but they just didn't manage it. And there was a galloping attack on them by the Canadian Cavalry Brigade.
Did you see that then?
I was looking at it, and yet in our area, to show you the difference, there could be. 2 miles away, they were engaged in a furious battle, yet where I was in the hut at Villers Breton, I was standing looking at it, not a shell had fallen and not a bullet was coming. It was quiet.
What could you actually see of these goings on?
All the shell bursts and the noise and the sound. I couldn't see the actual action, of course, but the bombardment was terrific.
Did you stay long at this hut at first aid?
We stayed about four or five days, and then we went back to the main body and began to pull out of the Hamel area, because the Australians had come, and they took over the area from the river right up to Villers Breton, you see. They took it over, and they were in strength, and they were fresh, and confident, and that really marked the end of the German advance, except for about probably another 200 yards. Beyond that, the Germans never got any farther in that area. That was the end of their advance. Yeah. On our way out of Villers Breton, going back to rest. On the march one day, I noticed in the first village after Villers Breton, the civilians were piling their goods onto barrows and hand carts in preparation for flight. And an Australian sergeant came up with some men marching up, and he went up to one woman with a hand cart loaded up and says, "What are you doing?" She told him they were leaving because the Germans were coming. He said, "Unpack." He says, "Unpack." He says, "We're coming here." And my goodness, he was correct. The Germans never got any farther than Villers Breton. That was the end of their advance there.
Did she unpack?
Pardon?
Did she unpack?
Yeah, she unpacked there. Oh, I know. I just had time to see her as we were on the go, take her things off and take them back into the house.
What did you think of the Australians?
I thought they were marvellous chaps, wonderful troops, full of confidence, and there's no doubt about it. They were equal and probably better than anything the Germans could put against them.
How did the French civilians treat you during this retreat and such things? Is there any instances?
Well, everything except for one incident, we didn't get any trouble, but. I remember one day we were going through a village, and we stopped, halted, and a woman, one of the women of the village, in a rather loud voice, remarked, "La Croix Rouge, ils sont des embusqués," which in English is the Red Cross, these are the war dodgers, the shirkers. And I could have cheerfully flattened her, because when I remembered the wounded and dead of the field in our company, and especially Sergeant Camus, one of our own countrymen, who died on the first day of the Great St. Quentin battle, it came rather harsh. But I let it go. I made no comment, and we went on.
This is when you're marching back.
We're marching back to rest, you see.
So where did you go to rest?
Well, we went to rest about 30 miles behind the line. I can't remember the name of the village, but we went to rest about 30 miles behind the line. And of course, it was at that point that the 1st Cavalry Brigade were refitting and being reinforced, because later on, of course, they were part and parcel of the great August battle that started the retreat to the Armistice Day.
That's at Villers Breton again.
At Villers Breton. Yes, they had a marvellous run there. I wasn't there because I had been sent on a gas course which lasted nearly a month, and with three men on a gas course, because the gas was the Germans had developed some sophisticated gas shells, and we were there being taught what they contained and what to do or what not to do, or what we couldn't do with casualties, you see.
What can you remember about that? Where was this gas course
at? Well, it was I can't remember the name of the place, but it was about 30 miles behind the line, with a very, I should think, talented chemist conducting it, and he illustrated his lectures with drawings on the gas board, giving us the chemical composition of the gases, and of course, use of the new box respirator, the new and improved box respirator.
And the methods of treatment, were they still, for you, basically just covering the affected area of gas burns? What did you learn in
that? The principal gas the Germans used was mustard gas, and that was a nasty thing, because, you know, it attacked the vesicular parts of the body, the underarm, the side of the neck, all everywhere where there were lymphatic glands, and it burnt and burnt, and it was a very nasty thing indeed. You see, it came over, and all you heard was a little plop, plop, burst, and the liquid came out of the shell, and then when it met the air, it evaporated, and if it settled on you, then you were in trouble.
So when did you rejoin your unit?
I didn't. I completely missed the battle of August the 8th at Villers-Bretonneux, which started the retreat. We were still at the gas course, and I didn't rejoin the unit until about a fortnight after the battle opened.
So still in August.
Bon?
You'd be in August.
It'd be in August, end of August, yes, getting towards the end of August.
And what were you? Where was your unit, and what were they doing?
Well, the Germans were going back almost a bit every day, and it was a question of following up slowly all the time.
Are there any stories or examples you have of your duties during that time?
Bon?
Are there any stories or examples you have to illustrate your duties during that time?
Not particularly. We just took everything as it came, you know. We were sort of an open house aid post to anybody, anything that came along.
What was the course of your movements then?
The course of our movements was by the road, and we were going east all the time, and practically almost over the same territory that we'd retreated over in March. We eventually landed back at Maisimi and Ronsoy, the two villages where we'd been in action on the 21st of March, the first day of the battle.
Did you have much contact with the Germans, or did you have any aerial problems with them? Were they bombing or anything?
Oh. Every night, without a miss, the Germans were bombing us all the way. They bombed us all the way on the retreat from March. They bombed us every night going up from August right up to the end of October. Every night. But what they did was they attacked the roads. Most of our cavalry divisions, which were following them up and attacking during the day, every night they got off the roads and out into the fields and missed the Germans seemed to not bother, because I was with them one night and they dropped a flare right over us and lit up the whole place, which was swarming with men and horses, but they didn't bother about us. What they did was to attack the roads, and I lost a very dear friend, one of the drivers of the motor ambulances, who was simply blown to blazes with his motor ambulance on the main road that night.
Did you ever have any close escapes from bombs yourself?
Go on.
Did you have any close escapes from bombs yourself?
Yeah, well, yes, we had them close. As a matter of fact, we had casualties in the field ambulance from the bombing, slight casualties, but I never had anything too close to me, except all I had was they dropped the flares right over us and didn't bomb. They were after the main roads. They wanted the transport.
Do you think... Would they see the red crosses and try and avoid them?
No, I don't think they bothered about that, no. They wouldn't see them at night.
Well,
you see, at that time I wasn't with the main ambulance. I was with the forward cavalry party at that time, mounted as room.
So the mounted unit that you'd trained with in 1916-17 was now being used?
Now being used, yes.
So how many of them were you? Was it as it had been
four,
planned?
There were four of us. Four of us, and unfortunately, one of the men who was originally in my mounted unit, joined the first machine gun squadron. I don't know whether I've told you before about this machine gun squadron, have I?
I think he mentioned it, but...
Yes, unfortunately, he was one of the first killed.
So what was your role in this? How did it work in practice?
Well, it worked in practice that I followed as close as I could to the movement of the cavalry regiment in front, you see.
Did you see much of the fighting?
No, not much of the fighting, no, because, they move pretty fast. And we moved fast enough, but we had to be careful not to get in the way, you see, not to get in anybody's way. And all we did was to just treat casualties as they came, you see. The lighter casualties. The heavier ones we had to leave.
So were you using your Price stretchers that you described before?
No, we didn't use them. We did all our work was done with the hand bandaging, and etc.
So you just left people where they were.
Well, if they were bad, they were dressed and left for the follow up ambulance. You see.
So you were purely to dress.
Purely to dress, yes.
Yeah. What had happened to the Price stretchers? They were considered.
Oh, they were quite good. They were quite good. They were quickly used, quick and put together in and put back on the horse.
But why weren't you using them this time?
Well, we weren't using them because the advance was too fast, you see. It was all right if you had plenty of time, but we had to keep up with the troops in front.
So it was just patch them and leave them?
Just patch them and leave them, yeah.
Mr. Bill Collins, Reel 16. So your advance party was working, following up behind the 1st Cavalry Brigade. Yes. How long were you doing that?
We're doing that until practically Armistice Day. We were kept following up, you see, until the Armistice Day. And
did you have any problems with your shell shock, or had it died away?
No, I'd more or less conquered it by then, and being on the move, you know. Not having much of a chance, and not being under heavy shell fire. We weren't under heavy shell. We were on the move too much for that, you see. It was smaller stuff, you know, sort of small field artillery and small arms fire that was coming our way. Not many explosions. So I didn't have to cope with any heavy stuff.
Were your rations and supplies keeping up with you?
Yes, we were getting the usual bully beef and biscuits. That's as much as we could get. We didn't get any fancy rations. Bully beef, dog biscuits, cheese, jam. We were getting those.
So they were keeping up with you, and
yes,
no problem.
Yes.
Well, at night, would you be with the rest of the ambulance unit, or would you be separate?
No. At night time, we usually drop back to join the main body at night, and moved away in the morning. You see, because the horses had to be fed, and they had to be fed and watered, and tended, and that was not part of our duty. So we used to fall back at night to the main body, and get, move away early in the morning, you see.